23rd, and we'll open for session. We're going to go a little bit out of order. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 940A, Senate Bill 940A. Thank you. Sandy, would you update us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Committee members, Senate Bill 940A had a public hearing last week, May 16th. As you recall, this was a bill brought forward by the Water Resource Congress. It was allowing for an owner whose property has been foreclosed and sold in a foreclosure sale for failure to pay an irrigation assessment, 90 days to redeem the property by paying the amount of purchase. The purchase price paid for the property at the sheriff's sale, interest on the purchase at the rate of 9% per annum from the date of sale, and any amount the purchaser was required to pay in taxes on the property. At that time, the committee had several questions and concerns. The chair has requested that legislative counsel come forward and speak to any of the other concerns that the committee members might have. There was, as you recall, there was questions about had judiciary looked at this bill, and the bill came to us from the Senate Judiciary Committee. So with that, Mr. Chair.
We have those questions, or have you already shared those with Harrison?
I did the best I could in sharing them with Harrison.
Okay, we'll go directly to counsel and ask for interpretations then of those questions. And colleagues, if those aren't the questions that you are interested in, I'm sure you'll be happy to let me know so I can make sure you get to ask them.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, Harrison Conley, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I did review the tape of your meeting a couple of times, as a matter of fact, and I'm still not entirely clear exactly what your questions were. You were clearly looking for why the bill was not in judiciary. But I can give you a little bit of background based on some of the things I heard. Sheriff's sale provisions are generally found in Chapter 18. They are the provisions for executing on a judgment. Those provisions for a sheriff's sale, and the general rule is that the sheriff does set the date of the sale. That is the standard procedure. The writ of execution procedures, the sheriff's sale provisions, are made applicable generally to foreclosure of mortgages and liens by ORS Chapter 88. Beyond that, I guess the answer is that with respect to the various liens and assessments of one or another governmental entities, the principal act of that particular type of government entity or type of special district, to the degree that the principal act of that government, of that type of government, doesn't contradict the basic sheriff sale provisions, those provisions apply in foreclosing a lien or an assessment of a special district. In the case of these irrigation districts organized under Chapter 545, the existing law does allow them to foreclose a lien or an assessment and does not provide for a redemption period. I believe this bill provides for a 90-day redemption period. I think some of the questions were around typical redemption periods. Chapter 18 provides a 180-day redemption for the owner of real property. There are other similar or related provisions which might provide a little more time than that. And in fact, I found one, I don't know if I have a note, I didn't make a good note for it, but I found one that had a shorter period, I think it was a 90-day period. A related process, when the county sells property, not necessarily foreclosed property, but when the county sells property using a sheriff's sale, I believe in that case they provide, when the county sells property, for taxes owed to the county through a sheriff's sale provision, I believe that they allow for a 2-year redemption period. So there's some variation in the redemption periods that are allowed. One of the other things I believe that Christina mentioned, that she was not aware of any other special districts with no redemption period. In fact, water control districts under Chapter 553 also have no redemption period and allow and require that the judgment set the sale date. I would guess that I'm not sure which one of those was drafted first, the irrigation district chapter or the water control chapter, but I'm sure to some degree our office would have modeled one after the other as similar types of districts. So that is at least one other example of a special district which has foreclosure possibilities but no redemption right.
Do you have any questions for Harrison? Representative Thurman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of questions, Harrison. I get, first of all, what is a water control district versus a water... I mean, I understand what a water irrigation district is. What's a water control district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I would have to look at the specific principal act to tell you that. Fundamentally, I think they're very similar processes. You're going to do irrigation with either type of district.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Harrison, from your perspective, what happens to an underlying right that's attached to a piece of land? So you have a piece of property that's inside an irrigation district. They haven't been paying their assessments to the irrigation district. The irrigation district decides to foreclose. They foreclose on the property owner. What happens to the underlying water right? Because the irrigation district now has foreclosed, do they own the right, or does whoever buys the piece of property at the sheriff's sale have own the underlying right, or what happens to that water right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I am very much out of my depth with that question. I don't know whether the water right is attached to the land or the owner in that case. So I could look that answer up for you, but I don't have it in my head.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I kind of assume that Brendan is somewhere in our, has us under surveillance, in which case he'll probably be up here to answer your question.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I think that he has answered the questions that I was concerned about when we talked before, since my questions had to do with the basic framework of foreclosure and sheriff's sale and how it worked. I think he's answered the questions. I suspect if I were writing this bill, I'd have written in a much longer redemption period, just because the more normal pattern is for a much longer redemption period. But I'm not going to argue with the 90-day period in this bill.
Harrison, was there any specific reason other than what you've talked about? Did the water districts request a 90-day period, or was this just what came out of the Legislative Council?
Mr. Chair, I'm sure that I did not choose that date on my own. I assume that that is what they requested.
I know she's hiding back there from my sight, but I see and have heard that she was in the room, so let me get another answer to that question.
Chair Jensen, I assume the she was me.
Anita Winkler, yes.
Anita Winkler, Oregon Water Resources Congress. I was looking quickly through my notes. I'm sure that the number of days came from us, and I'm trying to remember how we got to the 90 days, because I think our group talked about everything from 30 to 360 days, actually. And I suspect that the 90 was something that my legislative committee could agree upon, given that wide range. I don't know if there was any magic beyond that.
So are you telling me there would be no heartburn if Representative Barnhart wanted to extend that to 180 days or something else?
If there's heartburn, I suspect there might be some minor heartburn just because of the uncertainty. When you start the foreclosure procedure, you'd kind of like to get it all done and have that farmer know he's got his property back by the next irrigation season. But beyond that, I don't think it would cause great grief.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other questions for Thank you. Yes, Harrison,
please.
If I could,
Mr. Chair, looking at Representative Brown, I believe that you might have asked another question in the commentary on the last meeting, and it was about the adequacy of the language on the top of page 2. I'm not sure exactly what you meant, and I could be getting into sort of dangerous ground here in terms of suggesting policy, but in looking at subsection 3 there on page 2, line 3, what we allow under this is that the redemption may be made with the payment of the purchase money plus interest and any taxes that the purchaser might have paid. Well, in looking in chapter 18, we have these provisions, and we also have language essentially to the effect of, and all sums the purchaser paid for the liens plus interest. It's entirely possible. I believe the basic share of sale provisions do not establish a minimum that must be paid. In fact, I think they're silent on it, but I think that the minimum essentially becomes the sheriff's costs in conducting the sale. And so it is entirely possible that the purchase price will not, in fact, have covered any of the liens. Ultimately, it could be the sheriff's cost plus a dollar, so that the person would get the property back without ever having actually paid the liens.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, now that you refresh my memory, I think my concern was that the person would have to pay the full value of his property to get it back, where the lien foreclosure may have been for some amount a great deal smaller than that. And so to regain your property, do you pay the full value of the property, or do you pay just for the foreclosed amount?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, I think what you pay is what the sheriff conducts an auction.
Yeah.
And as I say, I believe the minimum price is effectively, as a practical matter, is going to be the sheriff's costs.
Okay.
So if there is no competition at the auction, someone is going to get a very nice price, a very favorable price.
Okay. In a sheriff's sale of foreclosed property for taxes, I know that the county establishes a minimum bid price. In other words, they won't accept less than that. In this case, do they establish a minimum bid price?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, as I say, I believe Chapter 18 is silent as to minimum price, so it is my understanding as a practical matter that what the minimum price is, minimum bid, is the sheriff's costs. You're right. I believe you're talking about provisions from Chapter 275.
Just a comment, they might be making a heck of a buy then.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. And this is, I think that Representative Brown has opened up a really good area for questioning. As I look at the existing law in 502 sub 1, it says on line 18 that the sheriff of the county shall order the sheriff of the county to hold the sale in the same manner as other foreclosure sales. Now, I suppose that might be read to apply various pieces of Chapter 18 because that's the way he conducts other foreclosure sales. I'm wondering if it would make sense, rather than trying to put the redemption amount in this statute, might it not make more sense to refer to an existing redemption statute, at least as far as the amount is concerned, that's already been thoroughly litigated and everybody knows what it means, rather than writing a new one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is certainly another option.
I mean, from a legal drafting point of view, or from a from the point of view of consistency, Wouldn't that make sense? And are, and maybe I better ask one more piece. Are there valuation statutes for both determining what the auction minimum bid is and what the redemption amount is that would force the payment of at least the amount necessary to pay the lien, which, of course, is the point of the foreclosure in the first place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think that the district is going to sue on and claim its costs. And so it will have the amount that they get a judgment for, and the amount is going to include their costs. I'm not clear that amount is going to be included in the minimum price that the sheriff sets.
Well, if I may follow up. I think that's clear here. But, and again, you're the expert, I'm not. In Chapter 18, where there's foreclosures based on other liens, does that chapter require that the minimum price at the sale include the amount of the lien as one of the things that has to be as part of the minimum bid or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I believe the answer is no. There is no minimum established in 18.
So in that sense, this is consistent with the existing law in other foreclosures.
The exception I'm thinking about, and I'm looking at 18.582 when I do that, I believe it's subsection 2, it adds, in addition to the language that's listed in 3, it mentions specifically and other sums paid by the purchaser toward liens. That in addition to recovering it for that the redemption price, in addition to being the purchase price paid by the purchaser at the sheriff's sale, includes any money that purchaser paid toward liens and any money that purchaser paid toward taxes. The taxes piece is here, the liens piece is not.
Is not here. Well, if I could follow up on that. If this section 3 simply said words to the effect that a person redeems a property shall pay the amount specified in ORS 18, whatever it was, wouldn't that accomplish the same result and get that extra piece into this list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it would satisfy the issue I just raised.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I'm doing to the water Congress's.
Well, I understand we're dealing with policy and the procedure of a sale all at the same time, and I'm simply asking you to comment on the procedural piece and the drafting piece.
Well, I think that pointing to 18.582 for the amounts that are required to be redeemed would bring an additional piece of consistency. Yes.
Right. Okay. Thank you,
Representative Barnhart. I'm going to recommend that between now and Wednesday, you get together with Anita and with Harrison on that, and I will accept an amendment if that is in agreement.
If we can come up with one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I also would to looking at the time or the date on this would accept an amendment to change that date to up to 180 days if there's not a lot of resistance on the part of the committee to that and on the part of the Water Resource Congress, and that will give you a chance, Anita, to run that by some of your folks too before we run off and do something half cocked on this. It had been my intention to just make a amendment here on the floor, in committee on that. But given that we've got a little more time, we can work on that in that way. So with that, I see that Brendan has, as I anticipated, come up to help us out with Representative Crummell's question. So thank you, Harrison. Thank you, Anita. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brendan, a couple of questions actually come to mind. One that I was asking Harrison earlier, and that is, in a foreclosure like this, and what happens if there's an underlying water right attached to the land and it's foreclosed? Does the water right then go to the new owner of the property, or does it go, or is it suspended, or does it go to the district?
Well, Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel, for the record, I can look into this further for you, Representative. Off the top of my head, given that water rights are pertinent to the land, I would think that the way it would operate would be that the water right would stay with the foreclosed property. Obviously, there's a process for transferring that water right, and I think the Water Resources Department would probably have some method for doing that in this situation. Offhand, I'm not aware of a specific one for foreclosed property, but I think the general rule would apply that water right would run with the land.
So, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, so Smith buys Jones' property. Jones' property has a water right attached to the land. Smith acquires the land. Jones isn't able, under this bill, doesn't redeem his property, so he loses his property to Smith. Then Smith would go through a process to get the property right into his name, but while he's doing that, the property would stay with the land, so he would be able to continue to draw the water.
Representative Krummel, Chair Jensen, I'm not familiar with the details of this foreclosure bill, but I think generally speaking that because the water right runs with the land whenever the foreclosure actually is final, and whoever the land returns to or goes to, be it the bank or another property owner or whomever the money was owed to, that person would then hold the property with a water right, and they would be able to do whatever the water right is there for, whatever the purposes of the water right are. Does that answer your question? Not entirely.
Not entirely, but let me sort of ask it a different way, maybe. If I may, Mr. Chair, and that is, if the under this bill, would a district have the ability to gain access to a water right that they wouldn't otherwise have been able to gain access to? So you've got Jones property, he's a part of a water district, but he hasn't been paying his fees, so the water district's going to foreclose. They're temporarily the owners of the property until it's sold at sheriff's sale. Are they able to maintain that or get access to that water right that they wouldn't necessarily otherwise have the access to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kimmel, I certainly welcome, knowing that Anita is here, her opinion on this. But my off the top of my head answer would be generally that the water district would continue to have whatever rights it has to maintain its delivery systems and that type of thing for the water right, but that the water right itself is going to remain pertinent to that land, and it can only be put to the purposes for which the permit was granted, and that type of thing, without getting further into the process and applying for some sort of change in place of use, time of use, manner of use.
Representative, begging your indulgence.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for indulging.
I'm going to not go any farther with this ownership of the water right.
Sounds good.
In light of the fact that in the last session, this committee attempted to define who owns the water right, which seemed to have caused Ms. Winkler a good deal of heartburn, and we might have a more clear answer to that had we done that definition. The definition of who owns a water right, it will depend a little sometimes on who we're talking to as to what the definition is or should be. So that's ground we've irrigated before and not been able to get a good crop off of yet. So we'll kind of let that part of the question set for right now.
That'd be fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Brendan. I appreciate you coming up. I think there's nothing else. And with that, we are going to close the work session on Senate Bill 940 with the notation that Senate Bill 940 will come back before the committee on Wednesday of this week. That Senate Bill 940 is closed. And we're going to just stand at ease for a minute here while I ask staff what are the complications that we have with 848. Do we have a it is to A2 amendment to Senate Bill 848, and I would, since that's Representative Krummel's amendment, I would ask him to quickly explain it to us and then to ask to have the amendment either up or down, a motion on it, we can go up or down on it. So.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to. Members, you'll recall that we had Washington County came in with this bill as far as 848 is concerned. They have a situation where they're also the county commission is also the governing body for a special district, and but they don't have the right to do conservation easements, and these are voluntary conservation easements. Clackamas County is also in the same situation, and so what the A2 amendments would do is set it up so that other counties can also take advantage of this. But this, as I mentioned, is only in the case of voluntary conservation easements, and so they would not have to. It would actually save the county's time and as well as expense. So it would we would delete the Washington County references and make it statewide. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would move the dash A2 amendments be part of Senate Bill 848.
Thank you, Representative Krummel has moved the A2 amendments to Senate Bill 848A, with that, is there discussion on the amendments?
Mr. Chair, just because we seem to be moving pretty fast, is this sets up a county service districts to operate, construct, maintain, and operate service facilities for the purposes defined in 451.010. What is that, Representative Krummel?
451 is I believe, and Gerald Kubiak from Washington County is here and actually may be able to answer my question or answer your question better than I can, Representative, but I believe that it is the ability of counties to operate these special types of districts, and in this case it's a water management district. Now, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Gerald to answer that question.
I'd be happy to. Chair Jensen, committee members, thank you for a couple of minutes here. Gerald Kubiak, staff with Washington County, also representing Clean Water Services. It's our ORS 451 County Service District that provides sewer services as well as surface water management and water planning functions. And to Representative Barnhart's question, he's referencing it there in statute himself as we speak, but in ORS 451 there are five or six subsections that pertain to different functions that county service districts are authorized to be created to do, and so what the reference in the bill to a group of those functions is intended to sort of draw a narrow circle around the types of county service districts that this is even applicable to. So you've got 1A, I believe it's 1A and 1B, and then 5, and those are subsections there. They pertain to services around sewer services, surface water management, and water planning. The bill does not open up this authority for even all county service districts. Rather, it limits it to just that subset that do water-related functions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to ask that question. If I may, I'd like to note that sub 5, which is the third item referred to on line 20 of page 1 of the bill, specifically says, within the boundaries of Washington County, master plans and service districts may be established. And then it goes on to talk about what those are for facilities, service facilities such as sewage works, drainage works, water, surface water management, and so forth. The other two provisions are simply referred to, A refers to sewage works, including facilities necessary for collecting, pumping, treating, and disposing of sanitary or storm sewage, and B, drainage works, including facilities necessary for collecting, pumping, and disposing of storm and surface water. So this may accomplish what Representative Kremel had in mind in the amendment, but 5, I don't know that 5 actually gets you there, because 5 itself is specifically limited to Washington County by its fit on its term, in its terms.
Section 5. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I lost you.
Yeah, I'm referring to ORS 451.010 sub 5, which is one of the limiters in line 20 on page 1 of the bill.
Yes.
And that particular subsection, by its terms, refers only to Washington County. Now, that may still, I mean, the bill may still accomplish what you're wanting to do in your county, but this section won't help you. This subsection won't help you. If you're concerned about sewage works and drainage works, I think you're covered. If you're concerned about something else that would be under sub 5, then I don't think you are.
Well, this bill, if I may, Mr. Chair, was actually drafted to basically fix the problem with regards to in Washington County of the issue with their sewer district,
right.
And that's what this bill was really, and it was very narrow in that respect. However, what we found is that once the bill got over here, is that Clackamas County has a similar problem, and I don't know if there's any other counties that have the same type of an issue. I'm not sure that there are, but in order to do a conservation easement, they actually basically have to, the governing board of the sewer district that is also the governing board of the county has to refer it over to the county governing board, then the county governing board has to act on it and then send it back to the sewer district. This way the sewer district board, which is also the county governing board, would be able to just do it in one fell swoop by making this change. And that's the understanding, and that would then, by removing Washington County in the areas that the dash A2 do, it would open it up so that for example Clackamas County would be able to take advantage of this if they so desired in terms of setting up voluntary conservation easements. That makes sense.
That makes sense.
Thank you.
We have a motion on the floor, and the chair is not going to move this bill today. We're going to hold it until Wednesday, so with your permission, if you'd withdraw the motion until Wednesday would make life easier for me.
Okay. That would be fine, Mr. Chair. I would withdraw the motion to adopt the A2 amendments.
Fine, and we will bring this back on Wednesday then for a work session. With that, the work session on Senate Bill 848 is closed, and with that, we then will get to the first item on our agenda, which is Senate Bill 579, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 579. And Sandy, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 579A comes to us from the Senate Business and Economic Development with 3 ayes and 2 excused votes. Left the Senate floor with 26 ayes, 2 noes, and 2 excused. It requires outfitters and guides to equip boats with throw bags. It also requires the outfitters and guides of non-motorized boats and their passengers to wear personal flotation devices on a Class 3 or higher rapids. It imposes a civil penalty. It requires that prior to an outfitter or guide physically providing services to passengers, the individual must have completed at least 1 trip on that section of water in a non-motorized boat. There's no revenue impact. It has a minimal fiscal impact on it. However, there is no subsequent referral to Ways and Means or budget.
Okay. And that we have, is it Julia? Julia Clark and Marianne Guest. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julia Clark, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. I support Senate Bill 579. I lost my father because of the lack of common sense on a guided fishing trip down the Rogue River, and I don't want it to happen to anyone else. Chapin Clark lived in Eugene for over 40 years. He had been a professor at and dean of the University of Oregon Law School. His contributions to the community reached beyond the university. He supported the arts, health, and human services, to name a few. He loved the outdoors, was a mountain climber and a river rafter. Safety and respect for the forces of nature were paramount to my father. When my father signed on for the guided fishing trip on the Rogue in October of 2002, he assumed that he would have a good time, that the people taking him down the Rogue were trained and safety-minded, and that he would have a great story to share with his friends and family when he got home. He did not come home. Friday, October 4th, 2002, we got a call saying that he had drowned when his boat capsized in Coffee Pot Rapids. My father was wearing his personal flotation device, as was the other passenger. The guide was not. Nor was there a throw bag on board to aid in his rescue. Valuable time was wasted waiting for help from the other boat, and my father's life was lost. In the deposition of the professional river guide, when asked if he had received any safety training, he replied no. When asked if the guide brought any safety equipment or safety gear on the trip besides personal flotation devices, he replied no. When asked why he didn't have any throw bags on the boat, the answer was, it was not standard equipment. When asked if he had any practice skills of group rescue or group assistance for rescue, his answer was no. When asked if customers received any kind of safety briefing, again, the answer was no. When the guide was asked if the outfitter had any kind of rescue plan in the event of a boating mishap, the answer, again, was no. When asked if he had a personal plan, rescue plan in the event of a boating mishap, he again said no. Professional guides in Oregon are required to fill out paperwork, show proof of insurance, and have proof that they have taken a first aid course, but there are no other requirements. No requirement that the guides be trained in safety or rescue techniques. No requirement that the guides carry appropriate safety gear and wear life vests in difficult waters. Unfortunately, I'm here today to ask you to legislate common sense. I urge and respectfully request your support of Senate Bill 579 in remembrance of my father, Chapin Clark. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Ms. Clark? Ms. Guest?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Guest, and I'm representing the Clark family. I want to thank you for the opportunity to hear Senate Bill 579, which is in honor of Chapin Clark, Julia's father. We have worked cooperatively since this bill was introduced in the Senate. We worked cooperatively with the Oregon Marine Board and the Oregon Guides and Packers Association to come up with acceptable amendments on both sides. And so you'll notice the bill has been amended in the Senate to address certain concerns, and the bill is now limited just to non-motorized boats that travel in Class 3 or higher rapids. And the three areas are that the boat or the guide shall carry a throw bag, that the every passenger on the boat, including the guide, shall wear a life vest, and three, that the guide should be trained in whitewater safety rescue training. So we've got a bill that seems to satisfy everyone, and we hope you will support it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Andrew.
I don't have a question, Mr. Chair, but I am surprised that none of this has been required before, especially since in Oregon we do a pretty good job of regulating and restricting and everything else. And I don't mean to sound facetious, but I am surprised that some of the common sense things that are being brought before us today haven't been already made part of the statute. And maybe it's because everybody thinks that they're common sense, and so they would just.
Representative, I appreciate your comments. However, limited though my experience is, especially in all the areas of natural resources that this body is involved in, it seems like common sense seldom is present, and it also seems extremely difficult to legislate, but I'll leave my those biases out for this particular bill, and but I appreciate the comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have Phil Donovan and Paul. Is it Rainey?
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association, and with me is my associate, Paul Rainey. Obviously, the testimony of Ms. Clark paints a dramatic backdrop to this legislation. Having said that, we needed to identify a solution that would work statewide, and I just wanted to share with folks that Oregon's guides and outfitters are safely providing thousands of river rafting adventures and fishing trips every day. As some of you know, I work as a fishing guide and a rafting guide on the Deschutes, and I can assure you that the legislation before you today reflects the common practices of the Oregon's guiding community. We've been in discussions with the proponents of this legislation since the beginning of session, and we have worked with them to put in place increased safety regulations for whitewater guides and recreational users, and as a result, we support Senate Bill 579 as amended. The livelihood of Oregon's guides and outfitters clearly relies heavily on our ability to provide safe and rewarding experiences for Oregonians. In nearly every circumstance, a PFD is the very best safety precaution available. And allowing guides or requiring guides to develop an in-house training on the water that their outfitters and their guides will be working quite frankly makes sense, and that reflects my personal experience working for All-Star Rafting. We went out on the rivers that we were going to be working. We were debriefed in equipment preparation, the boats that we would be working with, understanding and recognizing the river characteristics, flows, techniques to drop into, in two different rapids, and also working on the ability to communicate with your clients to make it a safe environment for all, where everybody understands what's expected of them. So with that, we support Senate Bill 579 to set into practice the safety measures. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown. What does a Class 3 rapid look like?
Chair Jensen, Representative Brown, a Class 3 rapid is defined as having some level of difficulty. Well-known rapids on the Deschutes, for example, would be Boxcar, where you see a lot of the pictures taken. That is a Class 3 rapid. It requires some navigating skill as opposed to a Class 1 or a Class 2, which can generally be fairly easy to float over. Just as we were coming into the room today, I was trying to recall there is kind of a basic set of standards that define Class 1 through 6, a Class 6 being unpassable. Maybe the Marine Board that's present remembers what the name of that that measurement is. I can't recall it off the top of my head, though.
Go ahead, please. Mr. Rainey.
I'm just here to answer any questions.
Hearing no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And next we have Bill Redbloom from the State Marine Board.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bill Redbloom, Law Enforcement Program Manager for the State Marine Board, representing Paul Don Hefner, who is out of state on business. And I'm here to offer testimony on behalf of Senate Bill 579A. Before I start, there was a scale that I brought along. There was a comment made just moments ago about what the river scales were called. There's various scales, but the one that's pretty much widespread use throughout this country and throughout the world is the International Scale of River Difficulty, last revised in 1987, outlining the six various classes. I'm not sure if you've seen a copy of that, but I'd be happy to leave one.
Thank you.
The Marine Board registers all outfitters and guides, and currently there are 1,057 such outfitters and guides registered in Oregon. The majority of these, over 50%, are listed as fishing guides, with only 6% listed as whitewater businesses. Now, typically, these outfitters provide rafting trips on rivers such as the Rogue, Deschutes, John Day, Owyhee, Snake, and others, where riding rapids is part of the thrill appeal of these outdoor trips. As part of registration, outfitters and guides must furnish proof of first aid training and liability insurance in the sum of $300,000. If they operate a motorboat, they must furnish a copy also of their Coast Guard license. Senate Bill 579A would require outfitters and guides that operate on Class 3 or higher whitewater to carry a rescue throw bag and require guides and their passengers to wear a personal flotation device in Class 3 or higher rapids. The bill also requires outfitters and guides operating on Class 3 whitewater to receive training in equipment preparation, boat rigging, methods of scouting rapids, emergency procedure, and river rescue techniques. We've worked with the sponsors of the bill and the Oregon Guides and Packers Association on several refinements to the original bill in the Senate, and as far as we're concerned, we have consensus and the bill is ready to move forward. And lastly, we support the bill and encourage your favorable consideration. Are there any questions?
Questions? I guess, go ahead, Representative Cromwell.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but thank you. It almost sounds like in the case presented to us by the previous
witnesses that the it almost sounds like the person was operating in a negligent manner. I mean that the guide was operating in a negligent manner, but I guess that's what the bill is trying to fix, is then they would actually be found to be in a negligent manner. Is that correct?
Yes, by definition, we currently do have boating regulations for unsafe or reckless. The unsafe is a Class A violation. Reckless is a B misdemeanor crime.
Okay.
But sometimes those are hard to define given the statute wording.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Bill, what are the requirements for conducting these sort of business activities now, or what would they be if Senate Bill 579 were not to move forward? What would a guide have to do to be legal in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, I suppose if nothing were to change, it would go on business as usual. Usual meaning that there would be no additional requirements beyond the few that are in place right now regarding liability insurance and a first aid card, which is basically a standard one-day course for how to administer aid. Certainly there has been increased awareness, and our service providers, the state police troopers and county sheriff deputies who work in support of the Oregon's boating program are aware of each fatality that occurs in Oregon. Thankfully, there aren't that many. But when they do occur, they get our attention, and so they're more vigilant, I think, and as well as the guides themselves, they take notice of other accidents that are serious, particularly those that where there's a fatality, and even without more regulation, there might be a little more vigilance. But I think with the additional requirements in place, I think it would further enhance the safety of those folks that trust that an outfitter guide has the experience and the equipment to get them out of a difficult situation, or better yet, to avoid getting involved in a difficult situation.
Could you tell me what kind of requirements currently exist in some of our neighbor states, Washington, Idaho?
I'm not exactly familiar, sir, but I do know that pretty much all of the boating regulations from state to state pretty much mirror the Coast Guard or the federal requirements. It's difficult to impose additional restrictions on boating in this country without having reciprocity issues. I'm not specifically aware of Washington State or Idaho having any differences than ours. Usually it's just the boat registration, it's the minimal safety equipment, which generally means life-saving life jackets, PFDs, possibly a throw cushion, a Type 4, that can be tossed in an emergency. That would be on boats 16 feet or longer. But a lot of rafts and drift boats will measure below 16 feet, so they might not have that additional safety requirement. And other than that, unless they're carrying fuel and have an engine on board with spaces that could trap flammable or explosive gases, there wouldn't be any additional requirements.
Okay. Seeing and having no one else to test. Representative Barner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to testify on this bill.
Thank you, Representative. You wanted to go down in front?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative from House District 11. I have taken the unusual step of actually testifying on this bill today, partly, I think, because Chapin Clark was a very good friend of mine. He was the professor of water law at the university when I was a student there, and I took his course in 1970-71 school year, the year I graduated from the University of Oregon Law School. Since then, I've followed his career as a law professor and dean at the university. He also was a member of my church, and so I saw him quite often on many occasions. He was an outdoorsman, and he was familiar with the challenges of being involved in things outdoors. And I think one of the reasons why this bill is so important to me, in addition to the fact that it was he who drowned in this incident that we've been talking about, is that he, along with many other people, have relied implicitly on the expertise and the skill of guides that they hired in order to take them down rapids that they would not have attempted on their own. I think that certainly applied to Chapin Clark on the day that he drowned. And I think, based on the testimony we've already heard, it's clear that his reliance was misplaced, although he had no reason to know that. I think that one of the huge values of a bill like this is that it will set up at least minimum standards of skill on the part of guides, which I think most people assume they have when they hire a guide to take them down rapids in a river. I think also one of the reasons I suspect that the guides themselves support this bill is that it will reduce the chance of future incidents like this one and increase the likelihood of the thrill of a whitewater trip being seen as a safe activity for tourists and others to engage in from the standpoint of economic development in Oregon. My personal interest, of course, is the tragedy of my friend's death. Death leads me to want to see that other people do not inappropriately rely upon the expertise of river guide that the guide does not, in fact, possess.
Thank you. I hesitate to ask, and probably shouldn't, but in light of your comments about the only thing you remember about water law was prior appropriation, or remembered about water law, and I don't know whether that is explainable to the grade you may have received from Professor Clark or the years that have gone by. So maybe given a couple of variables there, it's better to not put you on the record on that, Representative. On a more serious note, though, I am somewhat, and it's there's nothing we can do about it at this point, but it somewhat bothers me that when we have people who are businesses for hire that enter into this, what I would call, relatively dangerous world, that we don't have or didn't have more regulations present, perhaps for others as well as Professor Clark. I'm reminded I flew airplanes for a lot, and there are some rather, and admittedly they're not the state of Oregon, but there's some rather significant regulations that are in place before I can take you as a paying passenger
from point A to point B. And while I might consider that as a safe mode of transportation, most people probably don't. And I'm struggling a little bit as we're listening to the testimony on this, representative, with why it is that we have to do things like this after the fact instead of before the fact. Why common sense hasn't told us before that there were some conditions that needed to be in place before we... So that's not so much a question as it is simply a conversation between the good representative and myself on this. And thank you very much, Representative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, we are closing the public hearing on SB 579A and reminding the members that, or not reminding, but informing the members in the audience that this is up for work session on Wednesday. And we hope everybody is familiar with it as time slips by between now and Wednesday. And with that, we have finished the bill agenda. We are going to open an informational meeting on the removal fill permit process. There's a report and recommendations. We have a panel, I guess, of three. Mr. Allen, Petkovic, is that right? And Mr. Lilly, and I have Christine. I thought I said Mr., and I apologize if I did, Christine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Patrick Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. And I guess whatever you choose to call us, we're all here. I'm joined today by Christine Sedjevic from the Department of Environmental Quality and John Lilly from the Department of State Lands. Appreciate your taking time today to hear a presentation on a piece of work that a group of about six or seven state agencies have undertaken in the last 2 months to look comprehensively at the permitting processes related to removal fill activities in the state. And make some recommendations, which we're gonna go over for you. This work really came out of a variety of things. The governor, at the beginning of his term, issued a couple of executive orders relating to industrial lands and to regulatory streamlining. Really of note in the regulatory streamlining executive order, which carries into this work, was the notion that this work wasn't about lowering standards. It was about how do we achieve the same kinds of standards for protecting resources, the environment, and people in ways that make more sense or easier to understand and comply with, cheaper, faster, simpler. Similarly, the last session of the legislature created an advisory committee on agency rule permitting, which was asked to look at a variety of ways the state issues permits for development and other activities. It set up a water subcommittee, which looked at all the areas of water-related permitting, not so much made recommendations as developed a set of findings, which were a rich source for us of stakeholder input. And then about 2 months ago, there was a lot of talk, particularly through the Ways and Means process, of looking through the budgeting process at how we organize this work. The Governor's Natural Resources Cabinet in that environment asked the Office of Regulatory Streamlining to basically pull everybody together around a table who's involved in water permitting and do some fairly intense, fast-paced work at identifying what are some things that we can go do now. What are some things that we can do that will take a little longer to work to improve the system that we have and try to get ahead of some of that discussion. And so you're going to hear those recommendations today. This was fairly intense and fairly fast. We locked about 18 people in dark windowless rooms for 24 hours worth of work sessions over about a 30-day period. And you can imagine how exciting that was, you know, with the agency budgets and things like that swimming around. The charge to that group was to identify ways to improve the applicant's experience with the removal fill permitting process while protecting Oregon's waters. That was an excerpt from the charge. A couple of things about that. None of this effort was about getting different answers. It wasn't about how to turn things that were denials into approvals. It was about whatever, within the context of whatever the answers were, yes or no on activities, how could we get there quicker? How could we get there more cheaply? How could we make it clear to the applicant what was going to be required and so on? And we'll talk more about that. And the other thing is that although a major piece of this is Department of State Lands removal fill permit, this wasn't exclusively about that permit. It was about the full set of permits that are related to removal fill activity. So if I want to go do a project, I don't need often just a DSL permit. I'm going to need a DSL permit, and I'm going to need something from DEQ, and I'm going to need potentially a long list of different permits. And we talked about that whole system. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Christine to talk a little bit about the process we used to get there, and then John to talk about the recommendations the team came up with.
Thank you. I'm Christine Svetkovich with the Department of Environmental Quality. And thanks. Before I talk about how we got to our recommendations, I just wanted to give a little brief background about what kind of projects we're talking about. This is by no means comprehensive, but just to set a framework for where we are and where we're going, I wanted to describe, and some of the types of projects that would need permits would be filling any part of a wetland for a commercial, residential, or industrial development. Any sort of stream bank stabilization project may need a permit from the Department of State Lands and other approvals. Dredging, not only navigational channel dredging, but dredging by docks and marinas also usually trigger the need for permits. Any type of stream and wetland restoration projects, and additionally construction and maintenance of dock work. So again, to fill in a little more about what we did, so we had a group of staff from the Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of State Lands, the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, DLCD, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I think I might
Water Resources.
And Water Resources, in a room, and we met for about a month, and we had a couple half-day meetings, a couple full-day meetings, and we came up with a list of recommendations to change the existing state permit process. One of the things that we did that...
I had a question on the membership, because I was looking at the membership and I was just curious why there wasn't anybody from the general public invited, because I on the Water Reuse Task Force, we found it really helpful. We had several consultants, developers, private individuals that had problems getting a permit, to do water reuse. So I was curious, did you cull all that information before, or I just find it interesting that there was nobody from sort of the general public on this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, two answers to that. First is that in one respect, the advisory committee created through House Bill 2011 in the last session did a huge amount of work pulling those members of the public together to do a lot of work we were able to draw from in terms of articulating the problem. The second piece is that in the interest of trying to get some recommendations out, and particularly in an area where this is not a new set of problems or things that people haven't been talking about for a long time, we were trying to get a concrete set of recommendations out quickly. We did use a couple of, if you will, proxy customers. We had staff from the bridge program at ODOT and staff from the State Marine Board involved in the process who are agencies that pull a lot of permits and from whom who we could expect to actually devote 24 hours and 30 days to engaging in the process. All that said, going forward, as we talk about how to implement these requirements, that would be a hugely important process or step in the process is expanding that circle of who's at the table to include stakeholders and other members of the public to work on the recommendations.
Thank you.
So we spent a fair amount of time trying to define what the existing waterway permit process is, and what's interesting is that a permit from the Department of State Lands may end up triggering the need for a water right. They may end up triggering a water quality certification from DEQ and so on. And we realize that none of these permit processes or certification processes are integrated, and they're on different timelines. We talked a little bit about some of the applicant concerns that were brought to us that include the time it takes to get through the entire permit process, the uncertainty of all the steps in the permit process ahead of time to plan for those, to get everything done in time, and so on. We also came up with our own concerns. Again, some of those that included that we don't coordinate always as well as we can and should, probably, and we don't have good documentation to explain to applicants how to get through this permit process. And then, so we took all this information together and we developed a list of recommendations. Once we did that, after we defined the processes, we realized that we have two problems. One is that we don't speak as a single coordinated voice, and we don't have one process. And additionally, we what gets applicants to yes at the beginning is unclear. So, and before I pass this over to John, I just wanted to explain some of the things that the agencies have been working on, some different projects that are going to help in the permit process for applicants. The Department of State Lands will be implementing the State Programmatic General Permit, which is essentially one-stop shopping for a designated list of permit types, project types, and that will happen, I think it's in January, and that should help applicants a great deal. Additionally, the Department of State Lands has implemented new application forms, which are a little bit more user-friendly and clarify all of the requirements that applicants need to have ahead of time. And additionally, we at DEQ have come up with some stormwater guidelines to assist applicants ahead of time in drafting their stormwater management plans for post-construction stormwater. So with that, I will pass this on to John to explain to you some of the recommendations that we came up with.
Thanks, Christine. I'm John Lilly with the Department of State Lands, and I've been before you a number of times this session talking about the removal fill program and a number of different aspects of it. And so it's exciting to be here to talk to you about some new things that we're looking for and some really innovative work that the agencies are looking forward to do to really deliver these programs in a much more uniform way and a much more efficient way. And in fact, when you boil or distill down the recommendations that this group was able to come up with over the period of time that they worked together, they fall into maybe four categories or types of audits. One is to improve the clarity and of project expectations. In other words, we want it as clear as possible what an applicant needs to do in order to obtain a permit. We want to improve the applicant's understanding of the requirements, and we want to improve the agency coordination that goes on between agencies, and we want to develop staff competencies, particularly as it relates to customer relations and customer service. We're going to talk a little bit about that in particular as we continue through the program. I'm going to be summarizing and hitting some of the high points in the recommendations. As you noticed in the report, there are 32 individual recommendations. The recommendations are covered in pages 6 through 8 in the report. But I'm going to go through the slides and hit some of the more important ones or those that we think will really make a difference. Now, if you think about this in terms of home runs and singles, what we're going to talk about in the front end is a lot of singles, a lot of base hits. Now, if you hit enough base hits, you get people around the diamond and they score runs. And that's really what we're talking about is scoring runs, which means success for applicants. I think one of the most important things that we learned from this process is our facilitator helped us to kind of turn our thinking a bit from just thinking about producing process as our most important product, but rather thinking about it from the perspective of the applicant, the one who needs the permit in order to go forward with the project that they want to do. Probably the epiphany in that regard was that if you get a state division of state Department of State Lands removal fill permit, as Christina said earlier, the department is able to say, go forth and do your project. But the problem is many times there are additional authorizations, certifications, or what have you, that are needed from other agencies in order to really turn dirt, really go ahead and do the work. So our perspective began, how does this permit process look to the applicant? How can we really get to them to be able to turn dirt as quickly as possible and meet all of the regulatory requirements without lowering any of the standards necessarily that we've all put in place in order to protect resources from the, as to why these programs exist. So from the aspect of hitting singles and home runs, what we have here is two basic categories. We're talking about modifying the existing system and then the home run, which is kind of creating a new system. And they relate to the problem. The problem was speaking with a single voice and a single process and providing information that gets the applicant to yes. So in looking at these recommendations in particular, within the next 6 months, the group identified some things that we'd like to do. We want to do more effective or an aggressive customer service training, maybe building on some of the work that DEQ has done. We need to create a roadmap for the agencies and the public as to how to employ and take advantage of this state programmatic general permit. We want to develop some documents for applicants to use so that they're better aware of what the agency's requirements are and expectations in the processes and how they work. And then one of the things that we needed to do early on is that in order to know if we're going to be successful in all these efforts, we need to identify some way to measure our success. And so that was the developing the process measurement system. Within 1 year, we'd like to make sure that we have an interagency memorandum of agreement that exists between the key agencies that are issuing permits and relying upon one another for feedback on, particularly as it relates to how are we going to accept comments and input from other agencies when there's disagreements between agencies. How do we deal with those disagreements to bring the permit process to closure in an expedient way and still meet the requirements of the law. We talked about a super application. It's really kind of a web-based application that where an applicant would go to a central website, fill out the information about it, about his or her project, and then that would be the information that would be used by all the agencies rather than having an applicant fill out an application for DSL, an application for water resources, an application for DEQ, an application for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. All the information would be in one place. It would be shared amongst the agencies, so the applicant would really, in a sense, reduce the paperwork. A guidance document. This is the idea of both a web-based document, if you will, and a hard copy document. The idea is that when folks want to know what are the requirements for what they want to do, they could interact with this web-based tool that would help them understand, all right, if you're going to do stream bank erosion control and you're going to be down on the south coast, well, you may need a state removal fill permit, you may need a DEQ certification, you may need a county permit, a lot of other things that they would learn from just interacting over the web. Or if it were in hard copy, they'd be able to read through this document and parse through what they would need. And we'd try to make it clearer to folks what the regulatory environment is for them to work in. The challenge in something like this is, of course, making it interactive enough and clear enough that it gives people the information they need, but not so simple that it doesn't give them enough information, which is often what we find in some of these kinds of efforts, that we make it so simple that it doesn't give them the information that they need. And then finally, try to define and clarify the decision thresholds that the various agencies are using so that applicants know early on, okay, this is what I have to do to get to yes. This is the information I need to have. So when they enter into the process, they've done their pre-work, so it can slide through the process a lot easier. During the next biennium, we thought of work that could be done that would be very helpful, particularly work that's related to maybe unified project management. If you're doing a project building a residential subdivision, you may need a number of different permits that relate to the work, the development in wetlands and waterways. We think that putting on the web not only the Department of State Lands removal fill permit timeline, but also the other timelines that relate to the other certifications and authorizations that would be needed, and letting applicants actually see how their project is tracking over time, they could see that on the web, as well as the citizens and others who are involved in overseeing that project. Considering a multi-agency rule, this was the idea that, for example, the Department of Fish and Wildlife's in-stream work periods that are governed by whether there's fish present or absent in certain streams and during certain periods of time. Those are not currently an administrative rule. Maybe the Department of State Lands or the other agencies need to adopt those as administrative rules so that agencies are and the public are better aware of those types of standards that are going to be applied to them. A master list of permit conditions that could be put together for a specific project. Again, if you're doing stream bank erosion control, you know, these agencies have worked together for a number of years. We have a pretty good idea of what those conditions are likely to be. We should be able to put those out for folks to see, and they see what the standards are going to, what the conditions are going to be. And that way, they might begin developing and designing their projects so they meet those conditions as they come in the door. And then one thing that is a bit vexing, because we have a multi-agency permitting process with both the state and the federal government, what we find is that from time to time it's possible that one agency or another may require a little different project or modification to a project. And as a result, that sometimes results in additional cost for the redesign of the project, and the applicant has to bear that. Well, we'd like to put some time in to thinking about how we might be able to resolve some of those project modifications in a way that doesn't increase the cost for the applicant or slow the process down. There are some ideas out there, but we need more time to work them through and see what might need to be done legislatively. Some things we want to study further, ideas that we had that aren't quite mature enough to work hard on yet. One is to develop a consultant certification program that could be done for the wetland delineation work that consultants do. And we've had some conversation about that in this committee, at least in regards to what wetland consultants do and certifications of developing wetland reports that are reviewed by the agency. Offer expedited or enhanced service for a fee. Some agencies do that, not all of them do. It's an idea that's been around. We need to look at that more deeply. And then finally, one idea that's based upon the concept of creating an advocacy for projects is having an ombudsman who might be assigned to a project to help a project or certain types of projects through the process. Those are what you might call the base hits of our recommendations. Now we want to talk to you about maybe something that might be termed a home run, depending on what perspective you want to take. But it's creating a new system and fundamentally changing the existing system by, one, changing the product, and the product is authorization to do work, and the other is changing the level of service that the state provides to the applicant. If you think about the product that we deliver on a continuum basis, right now the state provides a kind of a loosely connected bunch of permits that relate to a project. The only thing that links them together is that the applicant has an idea, they put that on paper, and through the process at the end of the day, there's all the certifications, the authorizations kind of roll out. They're not sequenced in any particular fashion. We kind of deliver a package of permits at the end of the day, but what we'd like to move towards is a better consolidated package of permits, or maybe a single permit. On the service continuum, that is how we interact with the applicant, Currently, we're operating in the mode of gathering comments or referring service. When the Department of State Lands receives a comment from DEQ, DEQ might say, this project needs to have a stormwater management plan. We will issue our permit and condition the permit that the applicant provide a stormwater management plan to DEQ. So we are referring the applicant to the need to get another permit or another sign-off. And working down this continuum, maybe a better approach that's more applicant-friendly is working in this category of ombudsman, shepherd, or project manager. Words that mean somewhat the same. There's a little different connotation to the level of service being provided. But if you take the project manager at the bottom of the continuum as an idea, it may be possible that staff person is assigned to, you know, work a project all the way through, similar to what I just described in the ombudsman idea. So what would a consolidated permit system look like? Well, it could look like a number of things. It could be a single permit. It could be simultaneous processing of a permit. It could be simultaneous decision-making. It could be one permit. It could be multiple permits that are issued at one time. It could, but on the basic level, it could look like one permit to the applicant. We could also be able to provide a higher level of service to the applicants. That could be maybe through one agency, maybe through multiple agencies. We haven't spent a lot of time figuring out which agency this work might reside in. We have spent a lot of time conceptualizing what this consolidated permit might look like, particularly from the applicant's perspective. We've had product and service as our focus. The key point, I think, to remember is that agencies want to work together working to provide permits in a common time frame and with a common process. How it looks at the end of the day is still yet to be worked on. What we are preparing to take the next steps on is to start now to develop the management point of view, the budget, and a legislative package that we would bring back to the 2007 session.
I'd like to close then with just a couple of quick observations and comments. We do anticipate through discussions with Representative Morgan that a budget note will show up for the key agencies involved in this process through the Natural Resources Subcommittee of the budget on the House side of the Budget Committee, and I understand that's being negotiated on the Senate budget side as well. And it'll be reflective of implementing this set of recommendations. The second thing is that we maybe didn't say it very loudly, but this set of recommendations does continue to deal in the realm of having separate state and federal processes. A lot of energy has been burned over the last couple of sessions examining, you know, different ways to change that without a lot of consensus emerging from that work. And so we thought this effort would best be served by setting that discussion aside and focusing on within the context of separate state and federal systems, how do we make the state piece of this work as effectively as it possibly can. And then if at the end of the day, then the problem people want to talk about is how to get the consensus on the dual processes. We kind of leave performance and effectiveness of the state system as something that we've dealt with separately. And then the third thing is that the Office of Regulatory Streamlining has agreed to continue to act in a sort of convener and facilitator role to pull agencies together to work on implementing this. I personally think an advantage that we bring to that is the notion that as a subset of an agency, we don't really have a dog in the hunt of who does what work or those kinds of issues.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, just when you're finished, Patrick.
I'm done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for these recommendations. I think there's a lot of good information in here, and I'm looking forward to reading through the report. A couple of questions. One is, did you look at the idea of consolidation of state agencies? And I know this is not a new idea because I've talked to Gail Achterman, who they looked at this under Governor Goldschmidt. I mean, there's been many studies. I've talked to the former director of DSL, Pam Wiley, who said they looked at this. Did you guys approach that again, looking, because we have 14 different natural resource agencies. I know that Washington has Department of Ecology, California has a Department of Natural Resources that are umbrella organizations. Did you look at how our system works to other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I, at the risk of being over blunt, I guess I'd say that from what I can learn about this issue, two places that people want to seem to start are how do we organize state agencies and should we have 404 assumption or not? And so far it looks like starting the conversation at either of those two places doesn't get us very far in terms of actually changing systems. So far the way we've approached this is to really look at what is it that the product, what is the product that the customer needs, and what's the most effective way to deliver that product in a way that protects resources and environmental values and so on. And at the I think at the end of that discussion, if the logical, compelling answer is we ought to reorganize ourselves in terms of how agencies do work to do that, then so be it. But if we start the conversation with how are we organized, I think we run the real risk of not ever actually getting to changes and improving systems.
Can I follow up on that, Mr. Chair? Well, I agree. I mean, I don't think the conversation should be what should we look like as a structure, but looking at Washington and California to see if their permit process is more effective, because they do have some overarching agencies that, in theory, are supposed to help with coordination. And I guess, I don't know, John, if you spent time talking to your counterparts about that, but it might be of interest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I have looked a little bit at what Washington, California do, for example. And, you know, Department of Ecology in Washington has the 401 certification process where they work with the Corps. The Department of Fisheries and Wildlife also have a hydraulic permit that they issue for work in streams. And so in Washington, they've got two agencies doing some of the same work that we have. In California, the Department of Fish and Game has a similar type of permit that they issue for work altering streams. And I believe the California Department of Environmental Quality also has the 401 certification requirements that where they work with the Corps in that state. So we have some similarities. I think that the states, Oregon is unique in that it does have a state program that overarches wetlands and waterways in terms of regulation, and it dates back to 1967 prior to the Clean Water Act. At the same time, we've had pretty good working relationships with our sister agencies in delivering permits. I think, though, it's time, as we've done, is to step back and take a look at the way we deliver the product. And it may well be that at the end of the conversation, as Pat is suggesting, that there needs to be some conversation and some focus on how do we pile the beans up. You know, in which agency, and does it make sense to do? We're just not starting down that road at the front end.
If I could add one more thing on that point, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I think we're saying the same thing, that's a set of issues that needs to be on the table. It's maybe a question of timing. I will say, through the House Bill 2011 Advisory Committee, the water group, one person reporting anecdotally, but it was still of note, John Chandler, representing the home builders, as a part of that work, said that he went and surveyed some of his colleagues in other states, looking at states with multiple approaches to this topic, and said, so, you know, in the states where you have it all wrapped up in one agency, is it any easier? And the answer from his colleagues was, nah, it's bad here too. So, there was that one anecdotal report in that, leads me to want to look a lot at any kind of actual data about performance that people have.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the approach that you're talking about here. You should be taking deadly aim at the outcomes you want. And it appears to me that you've chosen the correct outcome to go after. If, in fact, a different organization suggests itself in the process of getting to that outcome, it'll be easier to make the changes, the organizational changes necessary, because they won't be coming out of theory. They'll be coming out of what's actually necessary to get to the outcome you're striving for. And that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I think I would concur, Representative. I'm not and never have been a fan of reorganization for the sake of reorganization. I think you accomplished very little with it. I've watched the state do it in a number of areas in the past, and I would hope we don't do it anymore in the future. That is not to say that if reorganization is necessary, if you know what you're going for first, then that's okay. But thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Appreciate the testimony. And certainly give us something to look at, think about, and perhaps even to hold you accountable for when we come back at a later time.
Absolutely.
And with that, there's nothing else for the agenda. We're adjourned.
Thank you.